concept of integration in relation to that then. So, I mean, I've been very much influenced and inspired by Jung. I suppose it's Jung that's helped me develop a sort of new understanding of where the implications of the Buddhist ideas take us. If the ego forms our projection of reality, it forms an idea of where we are and what we want. And the ego is also essential for us. It's essential for our operation as an organism, as remaining alive and so on. Yeah? That creates obviously an apparent difficulty, doesn't it? Which I think is equivalent to the wheel of life that we started with. You know? So the idea that we're stuck on the wheel of life and we're dominated by craving. That's another way of representing the idea that we're dominated by the ego and need the ego. So what do we do about this? Well, one approach is a traditional religious approach is to try and destroy the ego. I mean, that seems to me to be a deeply contradictory thing to try and do, because what you're trying to explode, though, you're trying to destroy the ground beneath your feet, really. Or you're sitting on a branch and soaring at it when you do so. It's also going to be a deluded thing, because what is it that's going to destroy the ego and to want to destroy the ego? Well, it's the ego. So actually the ego's just shifted a bit and it's identified another bit of itself and said, oh, well, that's the ego, let's get rid of that one, and got rid of it. But actually the ego's still there. It's the ego that wants to destroy the ego. So you haven't got rid of the ego at all. You've still got it.
Mm-hmm. But by all means, leave this to later. I'm cautious about interrupting and breaking the flow. But when you talked about delusional ego here, I'm just wondering if you can just say a little bit more about that and what you've just said in terms of you can't get rid of the ego. There's an assumption that the ego is a delusion at some level, or just that the ego generates delusion. Perspectives. Is there a distinction worth making there?
Well, yeah. So do you mean that part of the illusion would be this idea that we can destroy the ego? Is that what you're getting at there?
I'm just kind of picking up on the bullet point here that says delusion of ego only very vaguely aligned with individual interests. So earlier on we were talking about...
Oh, I see, right. I think that will be the case whatever the ego is identifying with. So this idea of destroying the ego might be partial. It might just be the ego's identifications with something external, or you decided is wrong. So supposing, I know you're prone to adulterous affairs or something like this, you're saying, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to destroy this lust or whatever it is, then. And you do this by turning yourself into a eunuch or a must or whatever, taking pills or whatever the attempt is. Yeah. And that's obviously going to be part of the delusion, isn't it? It's still the ego which is doing that. Is that getting at what you're asking about?
I'm not sure, but don't worry about it just now, because I'm
You can come back to it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So we can't destroy the ego. There's also another traditional solution is to sort of climb out of the ego, or to leap out of the ego. The idea of leaping out of the ego is something you find in Kierkegaard, the great Danish existentialist philosopher of the 19th century, who talked about the leap of faith. So the idea that you can't have reasons for believing in God and sort of taking refuge in God. You have to just take a leap and for no reason. And the whole point is there's no reason. And then you get to somewhere different. I can see the attractions of that if one feels desperate about the fact that one can't get out of the constrictions of the ego. But again, it seems deluded to me, because obviously he's making the leap, and where are we going to land? Well, somewhere else in ego land, I suspect. And I guess the all these kinds of approaches just assume some kind of metaphysical standpoint beyond experience. So rather than thinking, well, what can we do within our experience? They're putting a bigger model, including God, for example, outside that, and trying to look down at ourselves, but actually it's us looking down at ourselves. Mm-hmm. But that's the issue we're trying to get beyond the ego, but there's an alternative problem, which is the assumption that we're stuck with it, and so we just got to live in an egoistic life. And that's I would associate with relativism, and also with defeatism, really. So the idea we can't do anything about it, I would suggest, is just as deluded in a sense, or limited. And the reason for that is that the ego isn't fixed. I mean, the nature of the ego, what he's saying, is that it constantly changes, and the problem is that it thinks it's fixed, but it isn't. So it's constantly changing its identifications, and the fact that it's constantly changing is what gives us the opportunity of changing. So that's what enables incremental change, incremental progress. So that's why I think incrementality and continuity is crucial, because if you're trying to take a leap, a discontinuous leap, where you're suddenly somewhere else, well, you're probably back where the ego started, in a sense. But if you move gradually, you can shift those desires in some way. The process involved there is much more to do with, not with getting beyond desire, but with integrating desires, so with bringing desires together that would otherwise conflict. So integrating desires of the ego with other desires. So that, I think, is the crucial insight which I get from Jung, which is that's the kind of goal which is more appropriate for us. So I think you've got two desires that conflict with each other. Let's say a desire to smoke and a desire to give up smoking, for a simple example. Yeah. So you can't just kill one desire with the other or whatever. But you can recruit the energy which is given to one desire to work together with the other one for a goal, an integrated goal, a goal which both of them can join in with. Mm. Now to illustrate this process and how it works, I think the parable of the two donkeys is really useful. So I'll have a little illustration here. So this was, as you can see, it's been used by pacifists as a pacifist fable by Quakers specifically, but it has a wider currency. So as we can see, those two donkeys want different things, and they're conflicting with each other. What they have to do to overcome the conflict is change their model of the situation. When they change their model, they can both fulfil their desires. And that's a really simple illustration of how really any set of desires can be reconciled. In a way, I suppose it's an especially simple example because the two donkeys both want similar things, and the example, the situation is relatively straightforward. But the same basic process could apply to any sets of desires, I think. So obviously, if you think of the two donkeys as being, let's take my earlier example of wanting to smoke and wanting to give up smoking. Now there the answer isn't going to be a compromise in quite the same way as it is with the two donkeys. I suppose if one side of you wants to smoke 20 a day and the other wants to give up altogether, then smoking 10 a day will be progress of some kind, but probably longer term sustainable progress to get both those desires working together will actually be to give up. And that's because wanting to give up is a more sustainable model in the longer term. So that means that the side of you that wants to smoke 20 a day has to grasp in the longer term that, well, that desire itself is not bad, but the kinds of things that you want, the kinds of satisfactions that you want from that smoking will be better gained in the longer term, directed at other things. So, and obviously that's the tricky bit, is that shift of model and sort of recruiting those other desires into that shift. So some kind of reconception of the situation is needed in a way that can harness both the conflicting desires, the competing desires. And that new view of the situation is what I would call a more objective view, coming back to what we were talking about yesterday. This also links in just briefly with concept of metaphysics, I think. So if you think about the situation of those two donkeys, each of those has a fixed view of the situation, and they remain conflicting as long as they have this inadequate view that, you know, I'm a donkey which wants this pile of hay. It's that fixity of view in each case which causes the conflict. And that view which is inadequate to the situation. Although in some cases a resolution of conflict might look like a compromise, in fact it might be a compromise, in other cases it might not be a straightforward compromise. It might be more complex because the more important thing is that the conditions will be addressed, the conditions which those desires need to need for their fulfillment in the longer term. You can also understand this model in terms of dialectic. So dialectic is a traditional philosophical model for the process of integration, really. So if you've got two opposing forces, usually known as the thesis and the antithesis, and they achieve a synthesis. So if those two opposing forces are brought together, those can technically be known as a synthesis. Now, dialectic is used in different ways in philosophy at different times by different thinkers. So I won't go into that in detail, but we can discuss it later if you want to. In that process of integration, yeah, the ego isn't destroyed, but the ego is stretched a bit. So I think it's stretched a bit, both because the model or the set of beliefs we're working with gets a bit bigger. It takes into account a bit more of what's going on. And also the desires become more sustainable desires and more fulfillable desires. So if you change your model of the situation, then you can, to be more objective, then actually you're more likely to succeed on the whole, in general, on average. Doesn't mean it's a ticket to fulfilling all your desires completely, but it will. It's more likely on the whole to create the right conditions for doing so. So the ego isn't destroyed, but it becomes stronger and it becomes more objective. I think we can all experience that also in a micro form in meditation. So in a sense, every time you meditate, you're going through this process. So we encounter a desire to meditate, a desire to think about other things, and pretty soon, and certainly whenever I meditate, I encounter a desire to do other things, or to think about other things. And obviously the skill is to not just repress that desire to think about other things or to do other things, but to relax it and coax it into the meditation, into the process of the meditation. And so that's where, okay, so meditation, obviously physical relaxation is important, because in the process of physical relaxation, the ego identifications become somehow softer, more malleable. Now, I think that's related to the question of meaning and the fact which I'll talk about more tomorrow, that our identifications with particular ideas or symbols, if they're more centered and we're more relaxed, to become closer to the body, so they become more embodied sort of identifications rather than very abstracted ideas. So in general, I think it's easier to integrate ideas which we recognize as embodied or experience as embodied.
Mm.
So meditation can in itself demonstrate that for us, I think, and it can also demonstrate that incremental progress in integration is possible. You know, each time we manage to get going in meditation, well, we create a bit of momentum, a bit of concentration, and that obviously makes it okay for a while until a new conflicting energy comes up. We have to deal with that and so on. But each time we're making a little bit more of a contribution towards that momentum, towards integration. Okay. So would this be a good point to stop for a break, perhaps?
Mm.
And wrap and go on to the brain after that.